Dr. Future, hour number one, straight ahead.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks. Happy Future Tuesday. Here in the KCO studios, it's a nice, calm, warm, cloudy day today. Beautiful in Santa Cruz. A little sun today, too. It was pretty nice. And the waves, man. The waves are big out there today.
Yeah, it's been a pretty amazing ocean this last week.
Yeah.
Lots of it coming up over the driveway, seaweed in the road.
Yes.
That's what's happening on the beaches of Santa Cruz this week.
Our favorite thing to wake up to. Seaweed in the door.
That's right. That's right. The ocean is creeping closer to the front door. Do we care?
We do.
It makes us push the broom a little harder.
Yeah. We don't worry about it. I think that's the thing.
Well, you know, our show today, we're going to be talking with Bruce Erickson about climate change.
That's
so
true.
Yeah. We'll find out.
We worry about that.
The current state of worry for the world climate change and how soon we have to get out of the water.
That's on at 3.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, you know, you get to hear about some of our top stories for the week, including a little adventure that we had at the Fungus Fair, which was kind of fun. I just want to mention that. The Fungus Fair was quite a successful event. I thought it was really well done and well attended at the Loudon Nelson Center.
Yeah, the Fungus Fair is really a Santa Cruz favorite. We go every year. It's a blast to get to know your local fungus.
Yeah, our friend Jane is always trying to get us there early.
Yeah, she's a naturalist. She really loves the fungus and all the other kinds of life forms that are flourishing here around Santa Cruz.
Then this time we got to accompany our one of our friend's granddaughters.
Yes, 11-year-old Amber was very excited about the Fungus Fair and was
taking notes,
drawing mushrooms, making mushroom tie-dye silk flags. Lots of fun stuff for kids there.
Yeah, and I learned that if I wanted to, since we have 10 acres up in Boulder Creek, we could inoculate, inoculation as a way of growing mushrooms, our favorite mushrooms on the land. Like if we wanted chanterelles, we should be able to do that.
Yeah, and there were all kinds of mushroom kits being sold and actually fresh mushrooms. If you wanted to go and get some fancy mushrooms that you don't usually see in the grocery store, you could start at about $10 a pound and get some new varieties to try.
Yeah.
And of course, they're so beautiful. I took lots of pictures of the mushrooms.
Did you? Yeah. Yeah, I haven't seen your pictures yet, Mrs. Future.
Yeah, well, you'll have to check my Facebook page. Oh, speaking of Facebook, folks, if you want to communicate during the show with Dr. Future, you have a lot of options. You can call on the phone, 831-479-1080. You can send a tweet to at Dr. Future Show, and we'll see a question there. You can also send Dr. Future a note on the Dr. Future Facebook page, and it would be really nice if you gave us a like in the process.
Like us.
Yeah, that's the first time we've ever asked for a like on the show.
That's true. We don't do that.
Yeah. So
publicity, what's that?
Right. I've been listening to all the other shows and people asking for likes on their Facebook page. So I said, oh, yeah, we should do that. Okay. So anyway, we've got a great show. Got some interesting headlines, as usual, for the first hour here. Future news. Mm-hmm. Take it away, Dr. Future.
Well, you know, I do have a special report coming in next week from our friends who were at CES.
Oh, right.
We have a couple little tantalizing pieces we've just got to mention on the air here that are significant in that world, but next week will be the big CES report.
All right, so Consumer Electronics Show, of course, is one of the biggest gatherings of the year for all things electronic. This year, that included cars.
That's right.
Yeah.
And one of the big announcements was the Chevy Bolt.
Bolt.
As this opposed is not to the Volt.
Yeah, the Volt.
Yeah, which is their other Chevy car.
Right. So they've got a new version of the electric vehicle. This time it's the Bolt.
They've reach the magic numbers, $30,000, 200 miles on a charge, all electric.
All right. Electric for the rest of us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the company that killed the electric car is about to dish it out again, huh?
That's it. Yeah, the Bolt is the first electric car with a range of 200 miles and a price under $30,000 after a $7,500 federal tax credit, I might add.
Oh, so it's really $37,500, but then they knock that off with the federal tax credit?
The feds will give you the break.
Yeah, okay. So
the government's good for some things.
Thank goodness for incentive programs.
After all, they had killed the seminal EV1 back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But much of the technology from the EV1, that car in the 90s, went into the Chevy Volt, which you've probably heard a lot about.
Oh, it's not obsolete hybrid. Yet, huh?
No.
It's still futuristic.
Recycled. But the Bolt should go on sale later this year. It's pure electric. Builds on the legacy and leapfrogs Chevy ahead of Toyota, Nissan, even Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
GM had changed the nature of electric vehicle standards with this. They've got a 60-kilowatt battery, which uses an improved cell developed by LG. LG Chem.
Oh, that's a pretty good company. Mm-hmm. A lot of good things coming
out of
LG.
Like their little LCD projectors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's nice about this new battery design is that it retains energy capacity particularly well when it gets hot.
That's very important for an electric car.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They designed this car from scratch to fit a thousand pound battery pack.
Wow.
Its motor produces about 144 kilowatts, which is about 200 horsepower.
Hmm.
In the old standard.
200 horsepower, 200 miles.
And it takes about 9 hours to charge the sucker up from empty.
That's a deal breaker.
9 hours at 240 volts?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You can drive it for 200 miles and then you have to stop for 9 hours? That's not the way I drive.
Well, it's 25 miles per hour, essentially, about half of what you get with a Model S Tesla.
Huh.
But the 200-mile range means you can go for 200 miles without having to recharge. So if you're...
I think there's a Tesla charger that is a higher voltage charger that charges in 3 hours.
Yeah. Yeah, they're way more. And that's the other thing, is that the Bolt is no sports car, unlike the Tesla. Its 0 to 60 time is not 3 seconds like the Tesla. No. It's, what do they say, 7 seconds. Yeah, 7 seconds. It's quick enough for the road, but it looks like a bit more like a commuter car. It looks kind of...
So yeah, it's not
a fancy
It's not
car.
As great as the Tesla, but yeah. It's 1/5 the price.
Hey. And with the cheap price of gas these days... You'll hardly save anything.
All right, folks.
But it's really good for the carbon issues.
Okay, yes. Good. All right, so do some good for the planet. Think about getting an electric car. We're going to go to a break. We'll be right back. Dr. Future Show.
Okay, welcome back to the Delta Future Show. Yes, one of the other things that I thought was kind of amusing coming out of CES was the Marty McFly sneakers.
Back to the Future sneakers,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, futuristic.
Do they fly?
Sneakers, well.
What's so great about the Marty McFly sneakers?
All right, well, first of all, what's great about them, well, not so great about them is the $450 price tag, I suppose.
But, boy.
Hey, get this.
Status.
They tighten automatically. You know how these self-lacing sneakers that you had in the movie?
Throw your Velcro sneakers away. These are going to just clamp right onto your feet.
They
huh?
did. And they warm your feet. They warm your feet.
So
they keep them hot.
Foot warmers, like butt warmers in cars.
Yes. Yes. Foot warmers built into your shoe.
I wonder if that's good for you. I mean, that would make you get sweaty.
I don't know, but it's controlled by an app.
I don't know. I think sneakers, joggers, they're already getting pretty sweaty. I'm not sure if they're going to need foot warmers like that.
Because the design has the heater in the sole.
Well, we all need some of that.
And also sensors in the sole.
What does it sense?
It senses, I guess, whether or not you want to turn on the heat.
Yeah,
for one thing.
Whether your feet are sweating or not.
It's too hot. It's a new show. It's from Digit Sole. They're called the Smart Shoe.
Uh-huh.
And the idea is you're going to put some smarts into your shoes.
So this reminds me, when I first met you, you had a digital pair of shoes.
Yes, they are now in the Digibarn.
They're in the Digibarn. Yeah. And what were those digital shoes for?
Well, they were an experiment to be able to pace yourself, you know, be able to run and have your sneakers keep track of all the running data. And then you'd be able to put it in your computer.
Oh, so they were an early form of Fitbit.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the sneaker companies have been thinking about this stuff for a very long time.
Right.
And they keep on trying new stuff until something sticks.
So they counted your steps.
Counted your steps, and then you'd download it from the shoe into the computer, and it would plot your success rate and how many steps you did that day.
And, that's funny. Yeah. I always thought, coming from Las Vegas, I always suspected that they were useful for, like, counting cards in the casinos or something.
Yeah.
I don't know why I thought that, but I always thought they could be used somehow to do that.
Well, they do count. They count. Steps. I mean, they
right. It's like tap your feet like a horse, right? Count. Okay, there's three threes. Okay.
Well, these are considered the first intelligent footwear. They're not the first, of course. Many experiments have been done to make shoes smarter for a long time. The thermostat controls the temperature, causes the insole to heat up once it drops below a chosen setting from your app.
So I guess this is good in cold climates if you're, you know, needing warm boots.
They have a battery and a Bluetooth sensor, and hopefully they're waterproof.
You think.
You would hope.
But don't throw them in the wash.
They're made out of lightweight material layered with what they call ortholite, and it has shock-absorbing characteristics.
Hmm.
So if your shoe needs to absorb shock, it can do that quite well.
Well, I guess the idea of clamp-on shoes is probably kind of futuristic, right? You're going
to
need
that
once
you have, your shoes, yeah.
You know, if your shoes start doing more of the work for you in some kind of robotic way.
Well, if they could walk for you, I don't know.
Right.
The battery lasts between 8 hours if you use it continuously, or several days if you use it sparingly. And the insoles are charged with a micro USB charger.
All right. Well, there's an invention we never knew we needed.
Yeah, well, no, the sensors will tell you how many steps you make with your shoes and your distance and how much you've traveled and how many calories you've burned, all this on your app. They'll even tell the wearers when the soles have worn out and you should get a new pair.
Doesn't your watch already tell you all that stuff?
Well, it's my watch.
Costs less than your shoes.
This is my shoes with my feet. You know, this is actually sensors on my feet, which are different than my hands.
But my wrists. Tell you the same thing.
No. My wrist can't tell me how many steps I've taken.
Really?
Exactly. Well, maybe it can. I don't think it would be as accurate, though. This is a local intelligence in your feet.
Okay.
Right? You know, it's sensors in your feet. Let's certainly see. That's got to have some value.
I think the ideal app to have in your shoes would be a navigation app. You know,
in your feet?
I think that would be like telling if you were getting closer to your destination.
Yeah, turn green if you're heading in the right direction.
Point, yeah, turn right.
So they could be navigational aids. You know, they could tie into Google Maps or Siri.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Yes, the journey of 1,000 miles could begin with your next step.
Well, here you go. Michael J. Fox, eat your heart out.
Okay.
It's called Digit Soul.
Digit Soul.
Digit
All right,
Soul.
CES, the big news from CES, Digit Soul.
Well, the big news we'll hear next week.
It's actually not big news.
Yeah, this is the idea is that we are beginning to explore the possibilities of what smart shoes might actually mean. That's the latest incarnation of that kind of thinking.
So are you jonesing to get a pair?
I'll wear them. Yeah, definitely.
All right, clamp on shoes. Here we come.
Yeah. People have been worried about keeping drones in control and whether or not you can shoot them down if they get on your property and stuff like that.
Oh, I bet you're hypersensitive to people worrying about that.
Yeah, because I got a big drone. And
you
it's
got a big
obvious.
Drone.
It's go obvious out and it's flying.
Every day at sunset, Dr. Future takes his drone out to practice flying, get some nice sunset shots.
Well, just to keep things in balance.
Some beautiful aerial photography.
It's true.
Dad.
It's really awesome what you can do.
Yeah, especially this stormy weather over
stunning.
The ocean.
Stunning, over the ocean,
Oof,
yeah. Oh,
it's
my
been
God.
Gorgeous.
Beautiful wash shots of the waves as they're breaking. You just aim the camera straight down from right above the breaking waves. It's a beautiful wash. You'll be using videos as a transition scene.
Yeah,
awesome.
I mean, the drone point of view is very iconic. It's very recognizable, and yet it seems really fresh. You know, you just have not been looking at the scenery from that height and those positions before.
It's really remarkable cool. how you have that ability to take all these different points of view that would only be available through a helicopter before. So your videos just have this new level of production, the quality that's just stunning.
Yeah, and really a lot of the drones, especially like your drone, the unique drone, has really mastered the jitter problem.
Oh, yeah. It's
remarkably stable.
The gyro stabilization is phenomenal.
Yeah.
Just to keep things in balance, Chinese defense contractors have reportedly made laser weapons available for shooting them down.
Oh, really?
Yes.
They can take out your drone with a laser weapon?
Yes.
How did they do that? What does the laser fixate on for a drone?
They can disrupt sensors. A lot of sensors on these craft are what keep them aloft.
Oh, I see. Yeah, they have a lot of wireless technology in a drone,
GPS sensors.
Right? Yeah. So there's location sensors, there's camera signal sensors, there's control track sensors.
Some of the models have an acoustic ultrasonic sensor that bounces a signal from the bottom of the craft. I don't like to call them drones. I think of them more as flying robots, airbots, aerobots.
Yeah? You're going to call your drones an aerobot?
An aerobot, yeah.
You're not flying drones, you're flying airbots. Okay, let's go out with the airbot.
It's more accurate.
Take the airbot out.
You know, the term drone is just so... It's so
scary.
Loaded, right? It's loaded with...
right. Yeah, it really sounds like it's there
military
to kill somebody.
Uses, right.
Yeah.
You be nice to me, I'll send my drone after you.
Right, so we need to take back the magic of the flying airbot.
Yeah, and it is really the magic and the majesty of being able to fly and giving you that ability to fly around in space and get these great shots and points of view.
That first-person view.
Yeah, that's
nothing like it.
So the Chinese have created what's called the PY-132A laser, which was displayed at a Chinese police expo. It can be used to shoot them down. And also, similar weapons can also be used for disrupting other types of devices, not just drones, like security cameras, booby traps, or thermal imagers on tanks.
See, I would think that police probably, rather than just shooting drones down, would probably want to be flying their own. They would probably want to have an aerobot in the neighborhood, you know, because it could do some looking around for them and they could be safe in their cars while getting a little bit of information if they're investigating something.
I would tend to agree with you on that. And that's why I have another link to another approach.
All right, well, got 5 seconds and then we'll be back.
Well, okay, we'll get back to the robotic falcon after the break.
All right, folks. Dr. Future Show, we'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show. Oh, yes, you can also email us at future@ksco.com. If you have any questions or comments, please notify us and we'll retort back.
Get right on it.
Right.
Yeah.
So, a guy named Mo Rastgar, an associate professor of mechanical engineering at Michigan Tech University, and his team have developed a drone catcher that can pursue and capture rogue drones that might be...
In your face.
In your face, flaunting the law, doing things they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, I think there's two kinds of attitudes about drones. People are either really into them and can't wait to fly them, or they really hate them and can't wait to knock them out of the sky.
Capture them.
Right.
And Mo Rastgar has come up with a simple system where he has a drone that goes after the other drone and then a launcher from the drone that shoots a big net that then goes over the other drone and pulls it out of the air.
Somehow this seems like it could be a sport. It could
net
be
catch,
like, yeah, net catch, like, you know, some kind of chase sport with flying vehicles.
Well, it can fire the net from a distance of 40 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's more like a spider than a falcon.
Right.
In that sense.
Yeah.
Catch you with my net. And once trapped, the net swings down below the drone catcher, which ferries its cargo to wherever it wants to take it. So it captures it and
it's an interesting idea, a drone fishnet. I mean, this is right out of Terminator, really.
And the thing is, for serious threats, like if you think the drone might have explosives on it or something, then it will capture it and won't cause it to blow up, which is what you want.
I see. You can control where it's going to fly.
Where it blows up.
You can steer it out over the ocean like they do on 24, huh?
That's it. Foiling spy drones, too. Smugglers, terrorists.
Sure. Well, I'm really glad that our finest minds are learning to think like insects.
Yeah, it is kind of a mastery of the insectoid level of space. Because insects and birds are really what occupy drone space. And so we're learning how to think like those creatures, you know. But we're very smart creatures, you know. We are very good at biomimicry and copying what nature is already doing.
I'll take your word for it.
So this was called the robotic falcon. It sounds like better now than a robotic spider, I guess. But that's more
Falcons
what it is.
Falcons do not shoot nets at drones from 40 feet away. I'm sorry. I don't know. It's a beautiful name, you know. Falcon is a great bird, but it doesn't capture the essence of the
particular. And the other thing about this, you know, and what we have seen ourselves is that there's a whole new class of airbot drones that are racing drones. We had Zoe a couple of weeks ago talking about the evolving sport of drone racing. These little suckers go 7,500 miles an hour, and they're much smaller. So for having this big lumbering drone chasing you with a net, it's not going to catch the racer drones.
Yeah,
it might catch the other slow camera drones.
Yeah, you can barely catch the racer drones with a camera.
No, you can barely capture them looking at them.
That's right.
Well, that's another challenge. We'll drive them to becoming smarter.
Right.
The good news about the racing drones is that they're mostly purely recreational and fun, and they can't carry much weight, so much for...
Yeah. It's been really great to watch Zoe fly her racing drones because she just has such an elegant way of flying. Mm. It just amazes me what she can get these things to do. It's like modern-day barnstorming.
Way beyond what airplanes do, you know, because you can stop on a dime in reverse. And if she had some smoke coming out for tracing the flight, you could probably spell out letters with the racing drones and, you know, things like that.
It's, up for the challenge. Sounds great.
Yeah. So that's another interesting thing, that we're developing all these defense mechanisms against it. So let's go into something brand new, shall we?
I'm ready.
All right. Well, it looks like we've officially got four, count them, four new elements.
New elements.
New elements. Chemistry geeks, rejoice. The seventh period is complete.
Well, okay. So for us, we have new evidence of elements. I mean, elements themselves can't be that new, right? They're part of the creation of the universe.
Well, they're theoretical. I mean,
they're theoretical elements.
You have this table.
So we have proof.
They're supposed to be there.
We have four elements that we have proof of their existence, huh?
Mm-hmm. They've been going by their temporary names. Ununtrium.
Ununtrium.
Ununtrium. Unun.
I see. Trium. While they're theoretical, we call them unun.
Ununtrium. It's 113. Ununpentium, 115. Well, the famous element 115.
Oh, so
you've heard from UFO lore.
Trium is 113. Pentium is 115. Okay.
And there's ununseptium.
Septium. So these are creative numbers here.
And ununoctium. Guess what number that is?
118?
That's it.
Wow. So right smack dab in the middle of the radioactive line of the periodic table,
These elements do not exist in nature and can only be created in the lab by essentially blasting particles at each other with a particle accelerator. They don't last for very long either. Element 113, for example, exists for less than a thousandth of a second.
But that's an eternity in molecule time.
Well, we can measure it anyway.
Yeah, it's big enough for us to see.
Yeah.
Like Horton hears a who.
Yeah. And the research groups that confirm their existence actually get a crack at now naming them properly. So we might see some really clever names like Degrassium.
I see. These new elements will no longer just be wannabe numbers on the periodic table. They're going to get real names just like the other elements.
Element 115, euphorium.
Euphorium?
Yeah.
Really?
That's the famous element 115 from UFO lore about the supposedly what the reverse engineered saucers in Area 51 used as a fuel source.
Oh, really?
Yeah, one of the
classic stories. all those UFOs that fly around erratically are fueled by element 115?
That was the story. That was the story.
All right. And now we have proof.
Well, we have 115 that exists for thousandths of a second, but it probably doesn't have the fabled anti-gravity features that the Euphorium version does.
Euphorium. And this is coming out of where? Michigan, you said?
No, that was the last story. That was the drone capture thing.
The drone capture was from Michigan.
The elements have been confirmed by a Japanese research group and a Russian-American effort.
Wow.
113 was the Japanese. The American-Russians did the 115, 117, and 118.
Oh, the Americans and the Russians are interested in Euphorium. Okay.
Yeah.
I can understand that. We want to be the UFOs. We don't just want to find them in space. We want to be the UFOs.
Well, if you're going to have a cool drive system, you might as well at least have it yourself, and you can understand it and you can use it.
Sure. Okay.
You remember we had Chris on the show last week? He was talking about a new plasma drive system. Mm-hmm. I thought that was very interesting.
He was a font of interesting information.
Mm-hmm. And it turns out that is the case, too. We do have a plasma drive that NASA is supporting, the Vasimir plasma.
Really?
NASA's new Vasimir engine.
Uh-huh.
That is a real thing, and NASA is dropping another $10 million into it. This would allow us to reach Mars in 39 days.
Wow.
39 days. Okay, it opens up the solar system.
That's sort of like a leisurely trip.
It's tantamount.
Got a couple months to go see the solar system?
Right. It takes the solar system to the level of the oceans back in the 17th century.
Right. Sure, yeah. It took like 6 weeks to get across the ocean.
Yeah, six-week travels in those old boats was pretty standard.
Mm-hmm.
So being 6 weeks in a spacecraft could be even better, especially with the only entertainment systems we have today to keep you occupied.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I bet that it'll be way more fun on a spacecraft with computers and videos and Netflix than, you know, it ever was on those boats where people crammed into steerage.
Are you kidding?
You want to go explore the new world, you can take your university library with you.
So to give you the news on this, NASA provided $10 million in funding to Ad Astra, which is a rocket company in Texas, for further development of its what's called the Variable Specific Impulse Magnetoplasma Rocket, or Vasimir, an electromagnetic thruster capable of propelling a spaceship to Mars in 39 days. Their funding was part of a 12 Next Space Technologies for Exploration partnership that NASA has been promulgating.
Awesome.
Their Ad Astra rocket will travel 10 times faster than any chemical rockets of today and use only one-tenth the amount of fuel.
Right. And the big thing with these Ad Astra engines is that they're not for the part of the journey that gets you from Earth to outer space. They're to be used in outer space and attached to objects to push them through space to get them where they're going. We watched the Ad Astra trailer, the company intro, which was fascinating.
How it works.
And they were talking about potential uses for the Ad Astra plasma engine, which, of course, pushes things 10 times faster and takes a tenth of the amount of fuel. And they were talking about being able to attach it to one of the first things they want to do is satellites, like the space junk that is in the near-Earth orbit.
Lots of junk in space. Yeah, you want to be able to deorbit it.
Right. And, of course, the CEO of the Ad Astra company is a former International Space Station astronaut, and he's a man who's been to space a dozen times.
Yeah, Franklin, I think his name was.
Franklin, and he was talking about how on one of their missions, they had to like stop everything for a day because they had to deal with incoming space junk that was going to destroy part of the space station if they didn't deal with it. So, you know,
this would be a more efficient way to do it. Now, just to give you, for the geeks out there, a little bit of background on how it works. It's a plasma engine. It heats plasma, which is an electrically charged gas, to extremely high temperatures using radio waves. Now, when I'm talking extremely high temperatures, I'm talking like 100,000 degrees, mm-hmm. as opposed to
most... Yeah, they're talking about it like star fire.
Yeah, it's more like the surface of the sun temperatures. The current rocket engines we use will maybe 3,000 or 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and they get a certain amount of thrust with this. This, when you use plasma and you eject it, as opposed to normal rocket fuel, it'll get way, way more thrust. Way, way, way more thrust for way less of fuel. Hmm. 10 times more. It's electrically charged gas at extremely high temperatures. And what's interesting about it is that it uses, instead of a nozzle like you have with rocket engines, you have an electromagnetic nozzle instead of a physical metal nozzle, because metal would melt 3,000 degrees. So you can't use metal for the nozzle. You have to use an electromagnetic containment system.
Ooh, we're getting into force field tech.
Yes, we are. For real. For real. And this will open up the solar system to our exploration in time periods similar to the seas of the 17th century. It's really a significant breakthrough, I thought.
The new era is upon us, folks. Happy 2016. All right, we've got to go to a break. We'll be back with more Dr. Future Show. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to the Dr. Future Show.
Ooh, that one you had to rush in.
Well, since we're on space, last week NASA unveiled a new asteroid detection program.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. You know what happens when an asteroid hits the Earth?
Yeah, it's so amazing when you start looking at space history, how often asteroids hit planets.
It changes everything.
Changes everything
you take
for millions
for real.
Of years.
Yeah. You know, Mother Nature is pretty good at rolling with this, but...
Yeah,
any particular species aren't so great at it.
Mm-hmm.
However, our species, as clever as we are, we want to be prepared for this. So NASA is looking at how we can best defend the planet.
Mm-hmm. Are they calling for suggestions?
Well, they have a new system. It's called the Planetary Defense Coordination Office, or PDCO. PDCO, it's an organization that is assigned to coordinate all of NASA's efforts to list and classify near-Earth objects that are potentially dangerous to our planet.
Cool. So a unified space junk program.
Not just junk, but asteroids, too. Mm-hmm. NEOs, or near-Earth orbit. Mm-hmm. Near-Earth orbit stuff can be rocks coming into our purview.
Sure.
You know, a lot of big space junk is probably not that healthy for our cities if it whacked Empire State Building or something. Wouldn't be good.
Right. Well, we want to take the chaos out of the equation, right?
We want
to steer it gently down to safe landing.
The
spot.
Ocean, yeah.
Right.
So NASA has been engaged in this for some time, and this particular program will improve their efforts, and it's trying to basically do this by improving the quality of communications that NASA has with other organizations like FEMA.
Mm-hmm.
And federal agencies that may be involved with tracking space information.
Cool.
Yeah. If a NEO, such as a comet or asteroid, comes near us, well, keep in mind, a 7-mile-long comet could extinct us. So what they're looking at is how to intercept such a thing. How do you do that?
Mm.
You know. And so they're looking at the various approaches. Every different comet or space junk has its own strategy. And they're looking at the various mechanisms by which we can stop them and move them around.
Hmm.
Check it out. It's a very interesting article I found on this in Tech Times this week on the new asteroid protection program, PEDCO. The space mining company, Planetary Resources.
Ooh, beware.
Right? They announced something here.
Yeah.
These guys are looking at the solar system economy, and they're looking at how asteroids can contain more riches than most mines here on the planet. You can get trillions of dollars worth of platinum from a single asteroid,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they're convinced that the next trillionaires will be planetary resource asteroid miners.
Mm-hmm. Planetary Resources, founded by Peter Diamandis, the XPRIZE guy.
Right. That's a whole the Singularity University crew. Well, they've unveiled the world's first 3D printed object using not-from-Earth materials.
Where did they get them?
Asteroid metals.
Uh-huh.
A 3D printed model of a spacecraft using asteroid metals.
Oh, so they scraped up a meteor that landed and turned it into a 3D printed object?
They did. There's some nice pictures of it. The source asteroid crashed, landed in Campo del Cielo in Argentina about 4,000 years ago. And that material came from somewhere else in the cosmos, you see. So they used that material for creating this 3D printed model of one of their spacecraft.
Great. So now we can fly the asteroid back out to space. First, it landed here on Earth. 4,000 years later, the monkeys invent a new spaceship and fly it back out there.
Yeah, that's it. They can manufacture industrial-grade 3D printers that can process metal now, including metals from other worlds.
Wow.
The company says that the miniaturized spacecraft model was made from the Argentinian asteroid that was pulverized, powdered, and processed for the 3D printer.
All right. Boy, they can just put anything in there these days, huh?
Well, it's iron, nickel, and cobalt.
Okay.
Which are similar materials to refinery-grade steel. So this is pretty cool. So we can now print metal, and we can print things with the metal printers made from asteroids.
Okay.
How clever is that?
Do you have to get a special asteroid-only printer, or can it also print?
It's a new type of metal printer that they're talking about here. ProX DMP 320, in case you cared.
That's the name of the 3D printer.
Yeah, 3D Systems ProX DMP 320.
I love the way they give them such memorable names.
I know, right?
I guess they're trying to sell them to robots, right? They're trying to sell them to things that like long digital names.
Well, us guys get used to that. I like to talk about like the DMP 320 as opposed to the DMP 310.
Hmm.
You know, and the higher number is better, of course. Most of the time.
Oh,
or newer.
320 is better than 310. Okay. Typically,
well, yeah, you higher numbers.
Got it.
It's standard tech protocols we get to apply to numbers and names. And
yawn.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, the girls fall asleep with that kind of thing. But it means stuff, right? It can tell you details about what that gadget is based on its name as opposed to just being a name. You know, so it's great about tech names.
Wetware. How the trauma of life is passed down in sperm, affecting the mental health of future generations.
Yeah, that was a little disturbing, I thought. I thought I included it in the slate here. Yeah, the trauma of life can actually be passed down in sperm. Mm-hmm. You know, the children who have experienced extremely traumatic events in their lives that can pass that to their future generations. New research has shown that trauma leads to changes in the sperm itself. And these changes can cause a man's children to develop bipolar disorder. And they're so strong they can even influence his grandchildren, right? So whatever stress that you've had can be passed down, not one, but at least two generations from the research at the University of Zurich. And they believe that this understanding of how sperm can pass on trauma is leading to us understanding how the effects of traumas can be passed down from generation to generation.
Sure. And they're looking at the DNA, RNA structure. They're actually studying how trauma affects the DNA of mice. And then they're looking at the offspring of those mice for the same kind of markers and finding that there's a very noticeable difference in the DNA between the mice that were stressed and the mice that weren't stressed and the children of the mice that were stressed and the children of the mice that weren't stressed. So that the ones that were stressed are not doing their instinctual habits of preferring to stay out of the light so that the predators can't see them.
Yeah, it says, quote, after traumatic experiences, the mice behaved markedly differently. They partly lost their natural aversion to open spaces and bright light and showed symptoms of depression.